doubt, I think. But it is true that most people with borderline disorder, most adult studies have found that most no longer meet criteria after several years. As I'm sure you are fully aware, there's a very historically, there's been a very high risk of suicide in adult borderline patients. The impaired function continues on average, although maybe not with a severity we trust not, when they were mostly hospitalized. And comorbid personality disorder in the initial assessment or follow-up is associated with poorer function. But in the general population, we have many fewer studies. There are two major studies employed: substantial samples of college students screened and subsequently diagnosed positively for borderline disorder. They were each reassessed after 2 or more years. But these general population studies were actually college samples. And Mark Lenzenwanger did a study of Cornell students, and Timothy Truel, I've forgotten now the university, in any case. And what those two studies indicated about long-term outcome was that, as is true, I'm sure, in patient populations as well, symptom levels fluctuate over time. Recovery to symptom levels below the diagnostic level is common, but borderline disorder seems to have more lingering negative prognosis than most other personality disorders. But those are, as I say, relatively short-term follow-ups. And as Mary Zanarini is going to talk to you later about, I think, both the collaborative study and her McLean study have shown that personal, this is relevant to the issue of whether we can measure these disorders in general populations and predictive of the future as full diagnostic assessments. And this study has also, the collaborative study, suggested that some borderline diagnostic criteria may also elicit a sex bias in the tendency to make this clinical diagnosis. And that is, those two findings from clinical studies are important contributions to our feeling that our findings, based on self and mother report in our studies, and are also our finding of about an equal rate of borderline personality disorder in males and females, may be actually true. To go back to the previous studies that I mentioned, Lenzenwanger and Truls, both studies found higher rates of subsequent academic and social problems over 2 or more years. A follow-up of child and adolescent patients, there are three studies that have been done in the last, well, now we're nearing 2 decades. For these patients with borderline diagnosis or syndrome, most no longer met criteria on follow-up. There were some suicide or suicide attempts. There were many different diagnoses at follow-up, very impaired. Often they remained inpatient or in group quarters. And generally, these very impaired, predominantly adolescents, child or adolescent patients, were predominantly males at the initial assessment. So that's some of the facts about what we knew from clinical samples that are sort of important to keep in mind, I think. Relevant studies of borderline traits or symptoms in children are sparse. And you heard from Nikki Crick. I think her group is by far the main group studying these issues in non-diagnostic samples in younger children. That's, of course, because many diagnostic criteria are difficult to measure prior to adolescence. And until very recently, there was no structured or semi-structured assessment designed for borderline disorder in children. But as I, Nikki described to you, her line of work has found that there are certainly at least elements of the borderline diagnosis that can be assessed earlier in childhood. And she has several publications, some honestly I didn't know about until yesterday. But I, it is a wonderful line of work. I hope that we may yet have some influence on the national research community in mental illness. In I think this is a very important disorder. We need to understand it. So the only full assessment of borderline disorder criteria from pre-adolescence is the study I'm going to be describing to you. The children in the community general population cohort studied from early childhood to current data being collected at average age 38. So in some borderline trait indicators such as relational aggression and friend exclusivity are fairly stable over at least short year period, even in preteens, and a decline in symptoms with age is normative throughout adolescence and early adulthood. That may be, I hope, encouraging to all of you. So the study I will be describing is one I have been engaged in for a very long time. I have been supported by the National Institute of Mental Health, the National Institute of Drug Abuse, the National Child Health and Human Development, the National Institute of Justice, and the W.T. Grant Foundation over these it's now 25 years. No study like this is done by any one person, and although we've had some variations in the team over time, I want to particularly note my field director, Claudia Hartmark, who's been with the study actually since its inception, before I had the data, in 1975. And my wonderful group of current and past collaborators, active is this relatively large group, most of whom are not on my on the payroll of this, having had the cuts that other NIMH grants also have experienced. But I am happy to say we're also now, I'll talk to you maybe a little bit about the collaboration we're doing with some of the intramural NIMH researchers. So this is a sample that was originally collected, a random sample of people living in 100 randomly sampled block groups or tracts in Albany and Saratoga counties in upstate New York. Now, the original investigator, Leonard Kogan from City University and Shirley Jenkins from Columbia University School of Social Work, did this study of children on the average age 5, ranging from 1 to 10, based on a random sample of families in those counties, in those 100 areas within those counties, because they were at that time considered by market researchers and social researchers to be pretty much representative of the United States population. Now, the United States population has changed a lot since that time, so there are no Hispanics in this sample, for example. It is otherwise rural, suburban, urban, and dense urban. It has about the same proportion, which is about 10%, of black Americans that the general population has. Now, as I say, since that time, we have more immigrant groups. So that it's not so current population of at that age would be somewhat different. We have assessed all Axis 1 and Axis 2 disorders at four times. We're actually almost getting near the end of the fifth time now, from starting when they were ages 9 to 18. This cohort was born on average in 1970. They were born actually because they were 1 to 10. They were between late 64 and early 74. We assess those with interviews of the children and of the mothers. And those four have, as I say, the mothers, we stopped getting diagnostic information, although we have continued to study the mothers when these were young adults, and we felt they no longer were all that clear about what their children's problems might be. We have had clinical diagnoses only in the last two assessments. Before that, we were relying entirely on algorithms conforming to the DSM and used the diagnostic interview schedule for children that was for the Axis 1 disorders. Since there was no such a thing as an instrument, I invented one. Actually, I went to my colleagues and looking for something to assess in children, and they laughed at me and they said, "You can't assess these things in at that age." And so I didn't tell anybody I was assessing any that at that age. I used the Hiler's PDQ as a sort of a basis for what kinds of questions to ask, modified it as necessary to ask about age-appropriate symptoms or manifestations of symptoms, wrote new items when I thought you couldn't do it from old assessments. Just sort of to preview a little, we didn't know, of course, and this is in general, as I'm sure many of you clinicians know, a problem that whether mothers or children are going to be better informants about disorders is always an issue. And I think the bottom line is it depends on which mother and which child, and that's at least the best research evidence I've seen. We used both informants for as I say, for both Axis 1 and Axis 2 disorders. But we have found for personality disorders, actually, we found the adolescents were better in predictors of long-term outcome. And so much of what I'll be reporting on today, although many of our publications showing effects of adolescent personality disorders are based on combined reports. Some of what I will be talking about today are based on the adolescent reports, which seem to be better, as I say, for long-term prognosis. We also, by the way, have studied offspring, siblings. You know, we have a number of studies that have sort of grown out of this one. First of all, let me say, this is a very different study than the ones that you've been listening to all this weekend, because this is a general population. These are not patients. And, you know, there's nothing like doing a study like this to make a person appreciate how few of the people with problems get help. it is really kind of shocking to me how few of these people have had, certainly, I mean, not only not not the more intensive treatments that you have been talking about, but even relatively modest ones, particularly when they were adolescents. Now, on the other hand, although we have a lot of data on what services they did get, we have written too little about that. I'm still looking for particularly postdocs or pre-docs who are interested in studying those issues, which I think are still to be looked at. Any case, what you see here, this is these are not talking a selection of symptom variations over the multiple assessments of the those who had the disorder, but just a random sample from my population. So you understand that no matter what disorder we're talking about, symptoms go up and down over time, and so that's something that it's important to appreciate. It's not only happening in the people with disorders, but it happens that people come in and out of these problems over time. I have a little influence of my statistical background as best I can. I'm going to give you standardized estimates of effect sizes. This is just to give you a little sort of orientation. Something under 0.2 is a relatively small effect, but 2.2 to say 0.3 is a medium. Anything bigger than 0.3 is a large effect in terms of what we usually find in psychological studies. So borderline disorder, one of the things that that we can say about the symptoms is they diminish with age. In fact, I wish I could tell you now what's happening in our oldest cohort, that our current ones, that's going beyond 40, because we may find a leveling off there. But we found that actually we do not find, despite the all these the large sample, which I guess I forgot to say is about 800. That we do not find clearly diminishing decline in the symptoms with time. So over this period of time, the symptoms have gone down about, well, it's a large effect from, let's say, from our estimates at age 10, which was sort of the youngest people, to age 40 is over half a standard deviation. And it's linear, by the way. Another things I have to just say, now that you know I'm also a statistician, that one of the wonderful things about doing longitudinal studies is that you find that there's a lot of statistical power. So if things are curvilinear, you usually find it. A correlation of self-reported symptoms over time, over our multiple assessments, were what I would call comfortably large. They're not huge. These problems are not, a big, you have it or you don't. But the symptom persistence over time is pretty substantial when you think about, talking about 20 years. So they're quite large within adolescence, but they are also quite large when we're looking at from the early adult, the age 22, average age 22, to what we're having trouble finding. If somebody has a suggestion, we call this average age 33 full adult, or is that insulting to the late 20s? And what do we call those who are 5 years older now? Borderline disorder, not surprisingly, in early adolescence predicts later borderline disorder. In This is for those actually meeting the diagnostic criteria. As I showed you, the symptoms fluctuate a lot, and that means that for those of us who study these, we'd rather talk about symptoms than the diagnostic level, even appreciating that the diagnostic level has an important clinical significance. But so a lot of what I show you would be symptom relationships. But here in the transition years, the odds of having a borderline disorder, if you had had in your early adolescent assessment about 10 years earlier, are increased 11 and a half times. And in the, this is now 20 years later, they are increased 5.5 times. It's also very clear that comorbidity among the disorders in and across the DSM axes is rampant in both clinical samples and in population samples. The long-term prognosis, this is an article that we published in the archives earlier this year. Long-term prognosis of axis 1 and axis 2 disorders are of comparable magnitude and often additive when comorbid. That was actually a shock to me to see that they would be so nearly additive when we first looked at this. And this is over 20 years we're talking about. Here we were looking not at borderline disorder all by itself. We were looking at the personality disorders and the axis 1 disorders, for which there is each set of disorders in adolescence, and I think maybe thereafter as well, but we haven't done a full investigation of that, has about a 50% overlap. That is, in the at least in the general population, and probably much higher in patient populations. About half of those who met the criteria for any axis 1 disorder also had at least one axis 2 disorder, and vice versa. So our current work, one of the things that we're really looking on now is comorbidity. And two disorders that have shown comorbidity with borderline disorder in clinical samples are attention deficit disorder and bipolar disorder. These are and these disorders are also attention deficit, of course, in clinical samples of children, and a bipolar in clinical samples of adults. These disorders are also comorbid with borderline disorder in our cohort, the CIC, the Children in the Community cohort. This work may lead to better understanding of the basic and shared biological components of these disorders, and that's something we're really going into now. I'm happy to say that we're doing a collaboration with the NIMH intramural program with Danny Pine and his group. He was kind of a protege of mine when he was at Columbia, and now heads up the adolescent intramural program at NIMH. And with them, we're now just getting our genetic information on this whole cohort together to give you more answers in that area, we hope soon. So in the next slides, I'm going to give you some of the data from an article that we came out just last month. Greta Winograd, who was a postdoc of mine, now I'm happy to say an assistant professor with the State University of New York, is the first author on that paper. And you have actually a more thorough review of this paper in the paper that Alec presented yesterday. And then he said, well, he would skip over that section, but in your handout, it's there. So you may look at it there. What we looked at was well-being over 20 years for those who had adolescent borderline disorder. And here are some examples of items in the measures that we used for that. For peer support, I have one or more friends with whom I can talk about just about anything. The quality of their closest relationship. We comfort and help each other when we have troubles. And life satisfaction and self-rated physical health. So I'll just give you a little of that. Adolescent borderline personality disorder predicts 20 years later adult social support. And this is now what you see, which is about a, it would be called at least a medium effect size in social support over this trajectory from late adolescence to late to the late 30s for people who had been at the diagnostic level in the early adolescence. Role functioning, which improves substantially up to sort of the late 20s and then levels off, it the downward curve at this end, it shouldn't be taken too seriously. It's how well a quadratic function will fit. If we had a better measure of a ceiling effect, perhaps it would look like we're all getting worse as we get older. But here you see, I would say, a medium effect size between those at the diagnostic level and the average over this time. Relationship quality, and this was kind of a shock to me, for those who had the diagnosis when they were at the diagnostic level when they were early adolescents, there's actually a bigger difference from the norm that over this period of time. Obviously what we were expecting and kind of hoping that at least these differences would get smaller. There's also a non-trivial difference in how they feel about their lives over time. That did not change over time. Also here, I must say, the upswing in the 30s is probably also a consequence of the limitation of our quadratic equations here. And adolescent borderline personality disorder also predicted, these are self ratings of physical health. We haven't done a full analysis of which health problems they have, although we have data on that. One of the things I guess I should repeat is that longitudinal studies give you a tremendous lot of information to process over time, especially if you have a very rich protocol, which we do. And so there's no disorder that we have completed all the analyses that we can see ought to be done. Not, as you can well imagine, when we have assessments of all the Axis II disorders and all pretty much all the Axis I disorders, except for the very rare ones like autism, for whom we have no absolutely clear cases, let's put it. So attainment and function 20 years later is clearly a problem for those who had these problems in early adolescence, in education, in occupation, in interpersonal relationships. There's a differential odds of poor function as rated by clinical GAF. There's differential odds of adult diagnosis. They get they are less likely, about 1 degree less on an average at the average age of 33. Their impairment is reflected in their self-report of functioning. The odds of being severely impaired and in the GAF are increased on self-report over 3 times and on the GAF about 6 times, which is 10% increase of disorders for those with elevated borderline at age 14. Substance use is a little surprisingly small, I thought, significant but small, of major depression. Now, this is of in the age, mean age 33 assessment in the previous year only. We're not talking about ever. One of the things that has surprised me, and I think I mentioned earlier, we're now looking at are some of the common comorbidity patterns, and one of these is definitely bipolar disorder. Another, to my surprise, in our data, as has been shown, as I said, in clinical samples, is in attention deficit disorder. Those are big risks. Those two disorders, in fact, in early adolescence, are huge risk for bipolar 20 years later. I mean, for borderline 20 years later. So our developmental conclusions from the current data, borderline symptoms vary over time. Persons seem, when symptoms are particularly elevated, will on average show lower symptoms in some subsequent assessments. They are high when they are assessed in adolescence, suggesting an immaturity component that normatively declines over the development from childhood to full adulthood. Nevertheless, the functional significance of borderline disorder tends to persist over many years, regardless of age of first assessment. Where do we go from here? Well, we need to better understand basic biological genetic vulnerability to this very serious disorder. One of the other advantages of having a longitudinal data set, am I very close to my end? I've lost my time frame now that we did our coffee break. I'll tell you a couple of the current things. We haven't done the genetic ones, but one of the interesting things that we have recently submitted for publications has to do with early separations from mothers before age 5. And these are prospective in the sense that they were assessed in that very first assessment by mother report. And those are related to long-term borderline symptoms significantly. And so the question is, and I won't go into the details on whether this is attachment or not. It's not unambiguously an issue of attachment. Whether this is because this is not related to mother's illness, if that was the reason, then it apparently was a less risk. So it has something to do probably with either the problems that mothers saw. Most of it has to do with being away for quite some time, being taken care of by grandmothers or other relatives, or husbands, so this is one of the really interesting things we can't follow up anymore in getting how, you know, what all triggered that. We know the reasons they gave, but we don't know if these were very difficult children. We do not find unambiguous temperament differences reported by mothers. We do not find, fortunately, the original investigation included good prenatal and postnatal descriptions of the whole experience, pregnancy, early childhood, and other illness experience. So it's, you know, we have still a mystery here since we're very pleased with how much prospective data we have, but we need to people to look at these issues. So we do expect to find gene environment correlations, that this is where I think our genetic work has throughout psychiatry has taken us, that it's these combinations of vulnerability and environmental problems. So I invite you to visit our website for more information about the study, including our methodology, bibliographies by subject, and references for, we're going, I guess we're going well over 200 publications. So thank you. I'm not sure if I have time for questions. Was there a difference between ADD and ADHD in terms of being a predictor of bipolar disorder, of a borderline disorder? I guess BPP, yeah. I have trouble now because BPD can mean borderline personality disorder or bipolar disorder. In any case, the answer is I don't know. It's not that we don't have the data. I never looked to see whether hyperactivity as such predicted. And the other problem was, of course, that we don't have a clear adult version of ADD, but hyperactivity I don't think is really thought of as part of the adult diagnosis. And I don't think we have a measure of hyperactivity in adulthood. So we had to kind of make it up and take from the literature, whatever we could. So that's one of the issues in adulthood. Are college students really adults? Well, or post-adolescents? Well, let's see. You're younger than I am. You probably have some in your family. I leave that judgment to you. I think they vary, as we all do. I think there are some people who are adolescents who are pretty adult, and I guess there's a variation in those. What was the cost of my study in dollars? Do you know, I haven't assessed that, but it's expensive to do such a study, and that's a big, means a big risk for us in continuing the study. We took the same cuts, of course, everybody else did, and it's gotten more expensive I don't know that our, as this family, these people now live in, as I may have said, 40 states last count, and some even abroad. We are doing web-based assessments as much as possible now. We can't go, and we've had the best, I think one of the best records of keeping our sample. We have, by the way, the only loss, that bias in our sample now is that men are less likely to agree to continue to participate. But that's a small effect. We have no loss that's attributable to diagnosis, to SES, or to race. So sex is the only one we can find that's a difference. Over the years, well, the cost is maybe I'll figure that one day. You have to figure it all out for, since this is over such a long time. You would have to take inflation into account. Do we look at the influence of medications over the lifetime? We have data on that, but we have not. Other than psychotropic medications, I don't remember if we have the data. I know we have the data on mothers. on their mothers who are parts of this study and associated study, but I'm not sure what we have on the youth. But it's surprising to us, as I said early on, how few people are getting treatments of any kind, really. Could I repeat what I said about the predicting chart? Ah, what I about what I was trying to show you in terms of standardized effects. I was just trying to say about whether those, I'm not sure, those effects were how we should think about them in terms of the kinds of effects we usually see in psychology and psychiatry. If somebody has that question a little more, if I've got it wrong, they can come up and talk to me. So thank you very much.